Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, the last day of September. It's also the last day on the job for Hawaii Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald. Why his departure begs the question, who wants to be Chief Justice? Extensions on the deadline to apply fails to draw the minimum number of candidates. And this morning, we look ahead to a gathering at a Washington State resort run by a Native American tribe. We talk to the Hawaiian Council CEO Kohia Lewis about its upcoming convention. And why the Japan U.S. Council is holding its conference in Honolulu after more than a decade. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Who wants to be Chief Justice? Well, the current head of the Hawaii State Supreme Court, Mark Rechtenwald, took the unusual step of announcing his own interim replacement when two tries at drawing the minimum four candidates failed. Today is Rechtenwald's last day on the job. He turns 70 next week, the mandatory retirement age. And over his 15 years of public service as Chief Justice, he is championed for hiring additional judges and boosting their pay. We also recently featured the specialty courts that Rechtenwald has helped to expand. We're talking drug, veterans, and mental health court, as well as women's and girls' court. But it was a highly unusual and powerful statement that the Hawaii Court issued 6 months ago that reaffirmed its commitment to justice for all. In these trying times, we wanted to learn more about that, and we will get to that. But first, we asked him to address the replacement process.
Justice Sabrina McKenna is going to become the Chief Justice tomorrow, and that's by operation of law. So the next most senior person on the court becomes Chief Justice. But we're very fortunate because she's been our most senior judge in the judiciary. She's served in almost every court in our court system, and she's going to do a wonderful job. So I'm super excited that she'll be able to fill in until a permanent Chief Justice is selected. And the way the selection process works, an organization called the Judicial Selection Commission puts together a list of potential nominees, in this case for the governor, and by law they're required to have four qualified names on that list. And what I gather is not enough people have applied for them to be able to fill out a list of four folks that they're comfortable with. So they've twice now reopened the position and are encouraging attorneys who have the requisite skills and you know, expertise to apply. So I'm hopeful that this time we'll get enough folks to apply and they'll be able to put together and forward a list to Governor Green for him to select.
Well, you know, I'm not sure if you think the system ought to be changed in some way, because I think this is highly unusual, right? That we didn't get enough people to throw into the hat here.
Yeah, you know, I think our system is a good one. Many jurisdictions on the continent have elections for judges, and that's something I think mixes politics and judging in a way that I don't think is productive. I think what might be going on here is there was a recent change in the procedures of the commission to publicize the names of those folks who've applied for the position, and that's something that didn't happen before. So previously, only the individuals who actually made the list that goes to the governor would have their name released. But now, anyone who applies, their name will be released publicly. And so for attorneys in private practice who have clients who they've worked, you know, many, many years to develop, that could be potentially have a chilling effect on their business if they weren't selected. And that may be suppressing the number of folks who want to apply from the private sector. And, you know, that's it's important to have that kind of diversity of experience. But I'm optimistic that, you know, this next go around we will get folks who will step forward. And, you know, there are a number of people both within the judiciary and out in the community who I think could do a great job.
I have to ask you, because recently the Supreme Court issued a statement affirming principles of equal justice for all. And I know I was talking with Avi Soifer, the former dean of the UH Law School, and he said he, after reading that, he felt very proud of the Hawaii Supreme Court and, you know, in taking a stand and explaining what they stand for. What do you want to say about that?
Well, you know, for sitting judges, we had to be very careful in terms of not taking a position on politics, certainly, or really even on policy matters or issues that might be in another court. But what we did feel comfortable doing is affirming our sort of bottom line commitment to ensuring that here in Hawaii, the rule of law will be respected, that we encourage and value a diverse judiciary, and we encourage and want to show respect for everyone who comes into our courts. And, you know, really to just reaffirm our commitment to the rule of law. And so that was something that we thought very carefully about. And, you know, to me, the places where sitting judges can speak up relate to how the administration of justice occurs, as opposed to taking a policy position on some of the issues that are obviously in the media constantly. I think that really judges who are not on the court that are hearing those matters really shouldn't be weighing in. It's not a popularity contest, or we're not taking a vote among all judges in the United States as to how they feel. But judges should speak up and talk about how the system needs to operate and how the integrity of the system needs to be defended. So it's really important that we have lawyers who are willing to take on unpopular cases, for example, and that we have judges who are unafraid to rule in accordance with the law, even if that might be politically unpopular or unpopular with, you know, a large number of folks in the public. We have to call it like we see it. So those fundamental principles are what we were trying to reaffirm. And indeed, you know, if you look, Chief Justice Roberts spoke out about when there was a suggestion, I think, by some members of Congress to impeach judges who ruled a certain way. He spoke out about that. So that, again, it comes down to defending the integrity of the system as opposed to weighing in on the political issues of the day. And we thought the former was appropriate and important for us to do.
Well, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. Was it a difficult statement to craft or easy?
You know, it was something it came from the heart, and we're building on, when you look at the statement, it quotes our Constitution. It talks about the values that we collectively have as a state. It talks about the law of the splintered paddle, and how that reflects the values of equal justice before the law. So really, it sort of flowed from who we are as judges in Hawaii and the values that our own Constitution reflects. So, you know, once we decided that we could or should say something in this way, the statement kind of flowed. And again, we draw on what we're here for, which is to interpret our Constitution along with the U.S. Constitution and laws. But we have a wonderful Constitution in Hawaii that has, I think, really does reflect our values as a people. And it's our job to give meaning to that. So we drew from those values, and I think it made the task easier.
Well, you know, you followed up that statement with another one, reaffirming your commitment to providing language access to the courts.
That's right. And that was, you know, that was something that's been very important here. And again, it sort of reflects the unique position of Hawaii as a state that has two official languages, both Olelo Hawaii and English, and reaffirmed our commitment to allowing people who want to engage our court system in Olelo Hawaii to be able to do so, whether it's having their own interpreter or whether it's the court providing them with an interpreter, and whether they speak English or not, they have the option to communicate with the court in the language in Olelo Hawaii if that's their choice. And the statement was made in response to a declaration of English as being the official language of our country. But here in Hawaii, we have two official languages, and we also have a vast diversity of folks speaking other languages who come before our courts. And that's been a huge commitment, is to make sure that each and every person who does business with us or is appearing in court, we accommodate them by making sure that we have interpreters, qualified interpreters, readily available so they can communicate with us in whatever their primary language is. So we thought that was important to affirm as well.
You know, I know that you've been doing a number of interviews, and one of the stories that I saw was that you wanted to be an archaeologist initially. But I know you also said that one of the toughest decisions you had to make was about rail and the, you know, the archaeological inventory that had to be done, and that delayed rail. Have you been on the train
since? I have. Yeah, I took my grandchildren. It was a fun ride. We went all the way out to Kapolei and back to the stadium. But all of these issues, and you know, we're mindful of what's going on in the community. We're mindful that these are very significant policy questions, that there are hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars being expended on important projects that sometimes we have to weigh in on from an environmental point of view, or from, in this case, a Native Hawaiian Burials point of view. And really the point of that decision was, the reason we have to do surveys before the building starts to go up is to make sure that whatever is found, there then is a plan for how it's going to be accommodated, whether we're going to build the building around it or in some ways relocate those burials. That's done in consultation with cultural practitioners. So to only survey part of the rail line, which is what had happened, and then start construction out in the fields, out in the plains of the west side, really got the project rolling and a lot of money being expended before the really difficult issues of what's going to happen when that rail line gets into town. Is it going to affect a lot of burials? And if so, are there ways that it can be accommodated? And so the whole idea was to make sure that the process occurred with planning and foresight before this huge expenditure of funds was put into the project. So, you know, we had to stop and think really hard about the impact of holding up the project, but the law dictated what we did in that case, and so that was a decision we came to.
Any other cases that gave you pause, or maybe you kept you up at night?
It's interesting. I think I put the same amount of effort into every case. There was a similar issue somewhat with Mauna Kea back in 2016, where the process of issuing a permit for the project took place ahead of the actual hearing on whether there should be a permit and what the impacts of the project would be. And so, again, we sort of said, hey, this is putting the cart before the horse. You need to allow the input to be given from the community and others who are affected by the project before the green light is given for the project to move forward. So again, that slowed the project down, but it seemed again to us, you can't put the cart before the horse. You have to have an open, fair process to take input and then to make the right decision, in this case by the land board, before saying that there's going to be a permit. So, you know, again, that was one where, you know, we understood there would be very significant impacts. But again, the law to us dictated that you have to have the hearing before you have basically the decision in effect being announced. Now, so that, again, that's another one where we knew it was going to have very significant impacts, but we thought the law directed where we had to go. And that's always the case. You know, we understand that we live in the real world. We know the impacts that some of our decisions will have. But in the end, we have to call it as we see it based on the law. And that's why judicial independence is so important. You need judges who are looking at the law, applying it evenly and fairly, and not looking over their shoulders, wondering about the political impacts of their decision and whether that might affect their job status or compensation or anything else. It doesn't mean we're unaccountable. We hold ourselves highly accountable for the quality of our work, and we have a lot of ways of trying to give input to our judges to make sure they do a good job. But that the bottom line is, when a judge makes a decision, they should be doing it based on the law and the facts and not some perception of whether it's going to be popular or not.
Well, you know, I just had the opportunity to talk to Governor Lingle, and I know she named you. You know, and she was proud of all the people, you know, in her administration. And I know you are also losing your court's administrator, Rod Miley. He retires today as well.
Rod has been an incredible, indispensable partner for me throughout the work I've done here. He's worked for the state of Hawaii in various capacities for more than 45 years. He really is, for us, he's sort of our face and voice at the legislature. He has great credibility there because, you know, when he says we're going to do something, we do it. And when he says this is what the state of affairs is, or these are what the facts are about this project, or this is what it's going to cost, that information is accurate. And that builds, I think, has built great credibility for him over the years. And it's enabled us to get the legislature to sometimes give us a chance to develop a program that maybe, you know, another time in another place, they might not have been inclined to do it. But, you know, a great example is our Women's Court project, which helps women who are in the criminal justice system, gives them, sets up an intense sort of team-based approach to helping them overcome whatever trauma might have caused them to start using drugs and violating the law, and set them on a good path. That can take up to 2 years. And we got the legislature approved that as a pilot project, and now just this last session made it permanent and expanded it to Kona, and there was a lot of excitement in that community as well. And, you know, I think the credibility that Rod has built up over the years, people know that if they take a chance, give us some money to try something different and to get a better result, that we're gonna use that money wisely, and we're gonna get a good return for the people of Hawaii. So I'm so blessed to have had Rod by my side for almost all 15 years here, and I can't thank him enough for everything he's done for the people of Hawaii.
You've been listening to a conversation that we just had this morning with Hawaii Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Reckonwell. Today is his last day on the job. He is grateful for the experience of a lifetime, and what he will miss the most is working on a team pulling for the same goal. Mahalo and aloha, Chief Justice. Enjoy your retirement.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, Grammy-winning music producer Mark Ronson talks about his new memoir, Night People. It's a love letter to late-night New York City in the 90s, recounting how his early days as a DJ shaped him as a producer behind hits for Amy Winehouse, Bruno Mars, Lady Gaga, and more. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters La Piha Makahiki, a 100% ka'u blend with notes of strawberry jam, brown sugar, and sweet lime at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
This morning, we linger down at the courthouse. This week, Honolulu Civil Beat Investigations editor John Hill kicks off a series of stories about the foster care system. He joins us now. Good morning, John.
Hi, Catherine.
Yeah, I have to admit, you know, I read your story yesterday and it left my jaw just dropped. Because usually in family court, right, a lot of this stuff is because of privacy, it's secret or it's not generally out there. But you came across a certain case where it was all laid out in the court documents.
It was. And, over the course of the 3 or 4 years of litigation, this involved a foster dad who was accused of one of his former foster boys of sexually abusing him. And over the course of a few years, there were a lot of things filed and on the state's electronic court system detailing the names of former foster kids and stuff that happened at this house. And just a lot of detail in there.
And, you know, you folks are trying to get documents, and I understand there's an upcoming hearing in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so what happened was that one of the, among the many documents that were filed was one, and again, we're trying to, in our series that we're running this week called When Nobody is Watching, we were just trying to figure out what happened at this foster home. And many of these documents that were filed with the court system, you know, laid out kind of what happened, but we wanted to see some of the original exhibits that were introduced into evidence during the trial, a 3-day trial that occurred last year. And so we went to try to get those, and we couldn't find them, and eventually they located them in a box somewhere. And we were very interested in looking at those because those were kind of the original source documents that they were internal documents from DHS that laid out what happened in this case. And that's when things kind of got a little weird. So what happened at that point was the state intervened and said, there's no way you can see these records because they're all confidential. The names of foster children are always confidential and stuff, you know, their most personal, you know, at a difficult time in their lives, but none of that should ever be disclosed. But the kicker was that the state itself had disclosed a lot of the same kind of information in their own court filings. So on the one hand, they were sort of putting the stuff out there for anybody who had an internet connection to see. And then when we sought it, they tried to shut it down.
Well,
they are trying to shut it down.
Yeah, and you know, you have an article running today that's out, "Lord of the Flies." What else can readers look forward to for the rest of the week?
Well, it's a 4-part series. It's a lot of words, I'll tell you that, but we thought it was worth it. We're looking at the second day looks at the chances the state had to find out what was going on in this foster home and do something about it, and kind of missed their chances and discounted reports of abuse there. The third day is because this case happened, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we look at what happened to the former foster boys after they grew up who had gone through this abusive foster home. And some of the outcomes are not, you know, are really unfortunate and kind of tragic, actually. And then the last day looks at how it all came to light in the trial in 2024 and how the one plaintiff, J.R., we call him J.R., came forward and said what had happened to him and kind of what happened in the course of that trial.
So, I mean, really, you're trying to hold the system accountable for its responsibility and whether it failed in that way.
Yeah. I think one of the important points is this all happened, like I said, 2 decades ago. But one of the things we point out in the series is that it's the lessons from this are very applicable today because the foster care system still suffers from many of the same maladies that afflicted it during the time that this foster care home was in operation. So it's very relevant to today. In fact, there's about to be a federal review of the state's foster system coming out sometime soon, and we'll see how the state does. But in general, the state has struggled to meet these federal standards, and so what happened 20 years ago is happening now.
Well, we know these cases take a lot of time and effort, so we certainly appreciate you looking into this because, yeah, if there are lessons to be learned, you know, how do we do a better job of serving the children out there?
Well, I mean, one of the big takeaways from all of this was just oversight of the actual homes, and not just foster homes, but homes where children are living still with their parents, but where there's been a problem identified, and the state is supposed to go and check on these families once a month, and unfortunately, that has not been consistently done.
Okay, look forward to reading the rest of the series this week, but thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from John Hill, investigations editor at Honolulu Civil Beat. You can read the series about Hawaii's foster care system at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's quiz is about a soda fountain staple that once was a hallmark of local diners. This eye-catching product was at one time the second most popular fizzy drink in the Midwest after Coca-Cola. We're not sure when this soda made its way out west, but it became quite popular in Hawaii and California. For more on its history, take a listen to WGN Radio it's an interview with the brand's owner, Jim Akers.
As we acquired the brand, everybody kept telling us that It has more history. We just can't find it. We don't know if it's named after a river in Illinois, a potato farmer in Iowa, someone in Idaho. No one really knew. So I began to keep doing some research, and I finally found an article from 1914, 1915 out of the Davenport First newspaper. And it listed a person named Mr. Jones, who owned a confectionery store in Davenport, Iowa, who conjured up this green drink at the time.
Green drink. Oh, we're told that the younger generations in Hawaii have been introduced to this soda's flavor in the form of shave ice and Slurpees. For today's quiz, we want to know what's the name of this old kind soda. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
For two decades, the organization was known as the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement. That changed earlier this year when it rebranded as the Hawaiian Council, its tagline, Hawaiians Advancing Hawaii. Its annual convention was on the island of Hawaii last year, but the year before, it was in Las Vegas, Nevada, the first time it was held on the continent. This year, it's north of Seattle. CEO Kuhil Lewis explains the thinking behind the name change and why the council chose Washington State for next month's gathering.
We've been called so many different things. So I think it just makes it a lot easier for people to say the Hawaiian Council. The other reason is it gave us a chance as an organization to identify who we are and what we were doing. So we went through the whole exercise of talking about our destination as an organization. And so Hawaiian Council is just fitting. So it's new colors, it's new look, also a much simpler way of explaining who we are and what we do.
And one of the things that you do is to gather Hawaiians. You are in Washington. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we're super excited. The convention is coming. This is our 24th annual convention. And it's a chance every year for us to get together, not just Hawaiians. We've opened our doors to everyone. It's a chance for us to talk about Hawaii, where we are now, where we want to go as a collective. It's a chance to celebrate our culture, our heritage, to have some serious discussions about policies that are going on or conversations should be going on. So this year's convention, it is in Seattle at the Tulalip Resort, owned by the Tulalip tribe. And the Northwest tribes are very successful. And I think there's a lot that we can learn as Native Hawaiians about what's working for them. They have gaming there. Of course, there's gaming being discussed in Hawaii. Is that the model for us or is it not the model for us? The thing is, we should be talking about it. We should be looking at it rather than just staying here and trying to figure it out without hands-on experience. So I think for that reason, it's great that we get to explore. It's a chance for us to strengthen bonds and ties with Native people outside of Hawaii. At a national level, as you look at policies that are being discussed, Native Hawaiians are like not even in people's heads and minds. And so when you're banding together with other Native people around America, the voice becomes a lot stronger. So I think relationship-wise, it's just important. And this is something generationally over generations that has been maintained. So I think it's a responsibility we have to just be Native and be supportive of one another.
We had on a guest who talked about how the Native Hawaiians were just at a conference in that area, and they were looking at indigenous knowledge, and they were looking at the clam gardens, the limahui that went over there. It's just interesting, the sharing of knowledge.
Yep. I had a chance to go to a month ago to the paddle ceremony or a canoe ceremony, and it was so cool. It reminded me of being home. They're water people too, they're canoe people. And what would happen is all the Northwestern tribes would come over by canoe and they would stop at each of the reservations along the Northwestern and they would have ceremony. It was very uplifting, and it just showed like how much in common we have as Native people in connecting to the Aina, to the land, to the oceans, all of the things around your physical presence. So I'm excited. And not to mention, Washington has more Hawaiians living there than Las Vegas. So everyone thinks Las Vegas got a lot of locals there. Washington has more. So even more so why we decided to have our convention this year in Washington.
And the theme this year?
We didn't come up with a theme. So it's just a 2025 Native Hawaiian Convention. So much energy goes into creating themes, I feel. And so we just wanted to focus on this is our convention. This is our gathering. This is our celebration of Hawaii.
So whether it's examining that model of gaming to raise money, to advance Hawaiian knowledge and culture, or if it's looking at New Zealand, how they're harnessing geothermal and having the native peoples benefit from that, you're just trying to figure out what works in other places.
Totally. Economic models, and that's just the truth, is money helps move agendas. It helps build policies. And so we should be taking a close look at what's working. I don't know if gaming is the only answer in town, but there's maybe Pakalolo. Maybe there's other things that they're doing there that we could bring home and explore further. So that is very intriguing to me. Economic development. What models are working outside of Hawaii? What will work in Hawaii? And so this is going to give us a chance to check it all out.
And you are talking about marketing Hawaii to the world, right?
Yes.
You have acquired a couple of companies that will help move you toward that goal.
Hawaii to the World is an initiative that elevates Hawaii's talent to the world. If you think about it and you reflect back on some of the big artists that are promoting Hawaii, Amy Hanaiali'i, Robert Casimero, Lehua Kalima, they all came from some stardom. Even Kapena, Brown Bags to Stardom. There was Hawaii Stars. There was all of these amazing shows over the years which helped these artists become who they are or help give them the platform. And in return, they've become ambassadors in many ways. So we are launching a new show called Hawaii to the World, which allows us to elevate those gems in the rough so that others can see the talent that exists in our islands. And by way of that, it's a marketing tool. By way of that, it's helping these artists see their true potential. So we're excited. It's coming in November. First airing, it'll be prime time right after football every Sunday night. Get to check out some of the cool talent that Hawaii has to offer. And in the end of the season, we'll be announcing a winner that will go on tour with us to elevate their talent to the world.
And then we have seen the positive energy around productions like Chief of War and the care and the sensitivity about our history come to the forefront with productions like that. And I know the industry is having a tough time right now. Just this week, the president talked about a tariff on foreign films, films being made elsewhere. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we definitely need to pay attention to what's happening with Chief of War. That is an amazing marketing tool to celebrate authenticity in Hawaii. And it brings a sense of pride even for us. We need to do something about the film credit situation. It is an economic driver for our state. It keeps a lot of people employed. And then you have these amazing stories that come out of it that make us proud. And so we really need to find a solution to support authentic films. There's a lot of films that come here that, I don't know if they do their intended goal that we want, but we definitely need to support those films that are doing the right thing in helping to advance Hawaii to the world.
We were highlighting some of the pilikia, if you will, at the Hawaii Tourism Authority. And I know that you folks were involved. You weren't paid for a long time.
Yeah, there's no way around it. We were delayed payment. Millions of dollars was owed to us for work that we had performed. It's been cleaned up since. They've taken care of it. Jimmy has helped us to take care of past due bills, the DBED director. But HTA has been on a roller coaster for a while. It's made it challenging to execute the work that we have always sought to do in the tourism industry, which is to find a balance where tourism is supporting Hawaii's economy, people, place. But our work hasn't stopped. We continue to do it. In fact, we've augmented it. We supplemented it with our own resources to support where, you know, HTA has fallen short. Hawaii to the World is an example that's not HTA funded. That's, we're funding it, but it's connected in terms of promoting Hawaii's talent, our people. We've ventured into partnerships with resorts where we can help make resort areas more authentic, partnering with the city. So there's a lot of things that we are using the seat at the table to help do where HTA is not able to. I think once HCA lost its procurement authority, things started to unravel pretty quickly. So now they're having to juggle greater involvement of the political system, which can complicate things. But I have every confidence that it'll find its way so that it can be the agency that it was intended to be.
I think lawmakers had some concern, you know, when they were questioning HTA, when it was finally resolved, like the hundreds of thousands of dollars in interest that was owed to you because you were waiting just to get paid for the work done. And lawmakers were saying, what do you mean that it's covered? Was the contract padded? We're trying to understand, what does that mean for taxpayers' money?
HTA has for many years benefited from being a semi-autonomous agency of the state, which allowed them to move resources a lot quicker. In the case now where everything is under the scrutiny of the procurement system, everything gets slowed down. Even now, like where we're executing on behalf of HTA, payments are delayed because we haven't been paid to pay the contractors that are executing the actual work. So it's a double-edged sword. I would say when they lost their procurement authority, what it did was it added delays in payments. But at the same time, checks and balances are important. I think we just got to find the right system so that there's no holdup, because that costs money too. In the case of the interest, we didn't charge any interest in the end. We just wanted to get paid what we were due. But there's definitely cost associated with that. So I think it was an opportunity for us to recalibrate with HTA. Grateful for DBED to helping fix the situation. But again, the work doesn't stop. We're still focused on what we want to do, intend to do, which is create a balanced tourism model for Hawaii where residents don't feel the impacts of tourism as greatly as they do now. So it's whether it's regenerative models, whether it's more management, whether it's promoting Hawaii more authentically, those things, those missions, those visions still remain intact. And we just got to keep focused while HTA works itself out.
We hear that the numbers are down and people get concerned, but not everybody agrees that just to go up is the right thing. It was down so many percentage points. Doesn't mean that's bad. You right size, right?
Correct. And tourism's down everywhere. Just the state of the economy as a whole for the country has impacted tourism. I think we are an amazing destination, though, unlike anywhere else in the world, which if we hit the right messaging tone, we can continue to be that go-to destination. And that's what I was talking about. What makes Hawaii special is our people, our place, our culture. How does that shine through so that when visitors come here, that experience that makes us unique is seen, is felt? And that's what we're working towards. But yeah, it's a challenging situation, and all the players have to be on the same page, in the same boat, paddling in the same direction. That's hoteliers, that's businesses, that's government, that's contractors. And we've now been involved for 3 years, just almost 3 years. And I can say we are paddling forward. Sometimes the canoe goes back and forth a little bit, but we're going in the right direction. And I'm proud of the work that we've accomplished thus far.
All right. Any final thoughts just about the conference? Because it's coming up pretty quick.
Yeah, I want to encourage. I know this is a chance for not just Hawaiians, but for Hawaii, I feel, to be part of the celebration of our culture. I know it's called the Native Hawaiian Convention, but really I want people to see it as the Convention of Hawaii, where we can celebrate our home together. Yeah, I think that's important.
Okay. All right, Kohei Lewis, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was the Hawaiian Council's CEO, Kohei Lewis, talking to us about the upcoming 2025 convention to be held north of Seattle. The gathering runs October 6th to the 9th at the Tulalip Indian Reservation, a resort and casino owned by a Native American tribe.
Support for HPR comes from Bill Fernandez. In his novel Gods, Ghosts, and Kahuna on Kauai, John Tana returns, struggling to survive in the westernization of the islands. KauaiBillFernandez.com.
It's time to laugh at the headlines live. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming to Honolulu October 9 and 10. Get your tickets now. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org/waitwait. Sponsored by Hawaii Pacific University and Honolulu Financial Partners.
Between inflation, high interest rates, and a sluggish job market, folks aren't feeling great about the economy.
A lot of people who are out there are saying, you know, it's never been this hard to find a job. They're feeling really crummy about their prospects.
I'm Kristen Schwab. What happens when people are at a standstill? That's next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, providing full-service wealth management on Oahu, Maui, and throughout California. Learn more at thericepartnership.com.
Now it's time to carbonate the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a soda brand that was a local childhood favorite. It was created in Iowa in 1916 and swept the nation. Sales of this bright green beverage skyrocket every March because of St. Patrick's Day. And the band Creedence Clearwater Revival even released a song named after this beverage in 1969. Frontman John Fogerty said drinking this vibrant soda was a fond childhood memory. So we asked you to name this nostalgic beverage, which in recent years has been turned into shave ice, Slurpee, and even beer flavors. To give you the answer, here's the brand's owner, Jim Akers, on Chicago's WGN Radio.
Their parents, their grandparents, I remember going down to the corner drugstore or corner Woolworth to have a soda and an ice cream, and remember Green River, and they kind of remember that from their parents' days, too, and they want to keep that fond memory moving on with their own family.
Green River is the name of the soda. And mahalo to Cody Kawamoto, whose article in Honolulu Magazine inspired today's quiz. And we got lots of calls on this, but Leslie Hong from Wailaiki, who's 80 and who grew up drinking it, is our winner. If you have an idea for our quiz, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. For the first time in 11 years, the U.S.-Japan Council is holding its annual conference in Honolulu. The gathering includes a public symposium on October 15th, featuring guests from the Chief Technology Officer of IBM Japan to the Commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. But heads up, the deadline to register for this event is tomorrow, October 1st. HPR's Bill Dorman sat down with local executive Susan Icor, the chair of AIO, a collection of companies ranging from media and digital work to design, food, and distribution. She has a leading role in organizing the U.S.-Japan Council event. They talked about the council and its links to Hawaii, which come from the very beginning of the nonprofit organization.
The U.S.-Japan Council was founded in 2009 with the visionary leadership of our late Senator Daniel Inoue and his wife Irene Hirano Inoue. Both Senator and Irene felt strongly that in addition to our formal diplomatic relationship with Japan, it was so important to have people-to-people relationships in all sectors at all levels. And so their vision for the U.S.-Japan Council was to create a platform to help facilitate these relationships. Senator also felt, of course, that Hawaii could be at the absolute center of that relationship with Japan. So he certainly saw Hawaii as being sort of a very significant player in the U.S.-Japan Council. And I think he was right, because now we have about 1,000 members, both from the U.S. and Japan, but 150 of those members are from right here in Hawaii. So I think it's pretty cool.
And one of the Hawaii-specific programs right now the U.S.-Japan Council is involved with, Kibo for Maui, or Hope for Maui. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, that's one of those programs that really, I think, touched a lot of our hearts in Hawaii recently. So it's the story, actually, if you don't mind me going back, starts in 2011. and it was from the Great East Japan earthquake. So many of the young people at that time had suffered huge losses, their homes, in some cases their communities, tragically, in some cases their family members. The U.S. Japan Consul, working with the embassy in Japan, wanted to respond very quickly with support. And one of the areas that the U.S. Japan Consul felt really strongly about was supporting the youth. So they created a Tomodachi initiative. And specifically in Hawaii, one of the initiatives was called Rainbow for Kids, where young people whose lives had been so changed with the triple disaster came to Hawaii for some respite, for some care, and frankly, just being surrounded by kindness and humanity and to help the healing process start. It was a powerful program. And then we flash forward to the devastating fires of Maui. And it was just an amazing thing because the Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs reached out and wanted to create a similar program to bring the youth from Maui, whose lives have been so disrupted, to Tohoku to see and to provide hope that that rebuilding can occur, that those young people have now gone on to university, to great lives, that there is hope in a terrible moment. Since then, since the program started, a couple of cohorts have already been to Tohoku. And I don't think we can even really begin to imagine what positive impact that will come from that program for years to come. And I'd like to think that through this amazing relationship and kindness, maybe that next generation has now been given the tools and the hope to move forward and being robust and resilient and ready to handle the challenges that lie ahead.
Hope, following up, Tomodachi, of course, Japanese for friend.
Yes, absolutely.
Hawaii's role, on a broader sense, in U.S.-Japan relationships, is that changing, shifting, developing at all in different ways these days?
You know, I'd like to think that in so many ways, Hawaii is such a gateway for U.S.-Japan relationships. Right now, the consul is involved in many different initiatives, many based in Hawaii, startups, programs in sustainability and clean energy. One of the panels is going to be the legacy of Japanese-American family-owned businesses that are multi-generational in Hawaii. And also, there's huge interest for so many companies in Hawaii to share their products and their business in Japan. So the relationships through the U.S.-Japan Consul have really provided some great introductions, some steps forward, some trusted connections to sort of accelerate that process.
You know, the history of Japanese business investment in Hawaii has been up and down through the years, various stages. Where is that now, and what are there trends, or are there situations that you at the council see to highlight in that situation?
You know, I think that there's an understanding that these investments don't happen overnight, that there truly is an importance to building a foundational relationship. And so, yes, I absolutely see a lot of great energy around some future investments as well as things that are already going on. But again, I think when you're working with Japan, we want to create a very good, trusting relationship and then move forward. So I think the U.S.-Japan Consul has done so much in that area to support that.
I'm just curious now, with the Trump administration and the U.S.-Japan deal, where there are going to be billions of dollars in investment allegedly heading to the United States, is Hawaii going to get particular pieces of that? I know you probably, there's no way to know that definitively now, but is that in the air at all?
I certainly would hope so. I mean, I think that when we talk about sort of the cultural hurdles that happen with investment, I think Hawaii is, again, one of the perfect places for a lot of those conversations to occur. When I think about clean energy and sustainability, a lot of our climates, a lot of great work in Okinawa that could help both ways, both from Japan and to Hawaii. So I absolutely am bullish on Hawaii being sort of a front runner and a leader in some of those developments in the future.
Conference of the U.S.-Japan Council coming up in Hawaii. Susan Ikor, the chairman of IO, Honolulu-based collection of companies ranging from media and digital work to design, food, and distribution, also playing a key role in the U.S.-Japan Council in organizing this year's conference in Honolulu. Susan, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
That public symposium at the U.S.-Japan Council's annual conference takes place October 15th at the Sheraton Waikiki, but the deadline to register is tomorrow. You can find out more information at usjapancouncil.org. Well, that wraps it up for us today, but tomorrow we could be in the throes of a government shutdown. We are tracking several fronts. What do you think about these times? Let us know how you are affected. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.